The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, I'm just going to very briefly introduce the moderator of this panel, and I'll even attempt to introduce the speakers on the panel. We are delighted to welcome back Dan Burke, who I think has been to everyone of our conference. I think has presented at every conference, so we're kind of enlisting him to help and to encourage others to have the space to present papers. Dan is a professor at Minnesota Law School. He teaches copyright, patent, and e-commerce there. He's the author of numerous papers on the legal and societal impact of new technologies, including articles on scientific misconduct, on the regulation of biotechnology, and on the intellectual property implications of global computer networks, and he's the author of several papers on IP and gender. He has taught at Seton Hall, Cornell, Berkeley, Tilburg, and Toronto. He has served as legal advisor to many interesting governmental and intergovernmental organizations, including the ACLU Committee on Patent Policy, the OECD Committee on Consumer Protection, and the United States Department's Working Group on Intellectual Property Interoperability and Standards. So without further ado, Dan Burke will take over.
Thank you, Christine. That was very kind and way too long. From our panelists. So I'm actually going to keep the introduction of the panelists quite short, but biographies in your packet of each of these speakers. Looking forward to an interesting and stimulating panel. We're going to go in the order that's in the program. I'll just introduce them briefly now and then begin to give us some substantive discussion. So we're going to start by hearing from Rebecca Tushnet from Georgetown University here in the District of Columbia, who I think has been, if not to all of these conferences, at least most of them, right? She's a regular. This year we also have joining us from Northwestern University, Fumi Orewa, who will be our second speaker. And then finally we'll hear third from Séverine de Soulier, who is coming to us from the University of Namur in Belgium. Following Séverine's comments, calling her paper, I will make a few comments about the panel, as I've been asked to do, and then we'll open it up for general discussion. So, Rebecca, please.
So, I don't know, is there any way to dim the lights? Because I wasn't going to show this, but as a result of what we just heard, I feel compelled to start with an example of what I'm going to be talking about.
Will you sing too?
I will not say that. I think you'll find this perhaps better. Except for the horrific fact that it's not. This is terrifyingly sad.
Steve, audio.
So, well, let me give you some background. If we can make it work, great. If not, you know, such is life. What I was going to show you is an example of a fan work, a non-commercial work created for the love of it, and actually, in this case, out of both love and rage, perhaps like all mothering, this is an artifact of both a powerful love and powerful anger. So fans take original texts that are often subject to copyright, and they rework them. That non-commercially, they spend massive amounts of effort, sometimes massive amounts of money, traveling to meet one another, talking with one another, creating the tools to do these mashups and these rewritings. How does that fit in to the economic philosophy of copyright? What might we learn by looking at this type of creativity? So there are actually two models I want to talk about. They're idealized, and they in practice, of course, they overlap. But model one is the formal model of copyright incentives. The Supreme Court has said the economic philosophy behind the copyright is the conviction that encouragement of individual effort by personal gain is the best way to advance the public welfare through the talents of authors. Other ways of phrasing this, that copyright protection adds the fuel of interest to the fire of genius. Justice Souter the artist. Please stop talking. Right? I know that you have all these things inside of you. We've maybe heard enough from you for now. Many academics maybe are more on that side. People sing, they talk, they write, they draw because they have to, because it satisfies something deep inside them. Economics has this terrible ideology of preferences that is a complete black box that does nothing to explain anything, and I think misses a lot about what the impulse to create is, because of course it's dynamic. It's not a preference. It's something that changes through creation. So why talk about fan works that explicitly sort of muddle the formal copyright system and the informal non-commercial system together? Because fan works, I think, have proved incredibly attractive to academics, and particularly Splash, which is a particular type which generally focuses on creating male-male relations that didn't otherwise exist in the text. We're still working on the video.
It's
more on video?
Doing something.
You're doing something, but if we don't get the images, it's probably not going to work. So we'll see. Maybe at lunch I can show it because I really do want to. So the most academic analysis is focused on Splash, where say Kirk and Spock are reconfigured as lovers or potential lovers, and the subtext is read or reread as text. Why has this proved such an attractive field for study of a particular creative subculture? And I think it's because it involves women writing about sex or creating art about sex. In many ways, it does not compute. Porn is for men. And it's sort of like the return of the repressed. As it turns out, women do have sexual desires, and they express them in ways that are shockingly, unrewarded in popular culture, or only given sort of marginal glancing notice. And when offered the tools to rewrite the text to make them a little better, turns out at least some women want to read about men having sex. Moreover, there's this tension in model one about how the commercial marketplace is the place that creativity should live, which is, it's about the audience. So the audience is supposed to pay for access, right? You pay for something, you're a consumer, you're good, you're participating in the market. But why are you paying? You're paying, we think, because you actually like the thing. But at some point, your liking, it dissolves into a preference that we can't explain or value. Then there are people who actually, like the text, and then they invest in them. They talk about Harry Potter with their friends. They, write reviews. They write stories in which they go to Hogwarts. This is about liking the text the way that you were invited to, and then going further, over-investing, excessively investing, and that's how it reads from the outside. But the thing is, that is another part, another facet of human creative nature. If we don't have a little investment meter ticking in ourselves saying, okay, I've now invested $27 worth in Harry Potter, I'm done. So it turns out fan fiction and fan works have been also immediately understood in copyright scholarship as a sort of marquee fair use, a readily taken up example of what it is to make a transformative, creative use that adds a lot to the original. Why is this? Because I think it defies so obviously the market assumptions of Model 1 about investment and money. For one thing, it's not about scarcity. the pleasure of a text can often be about repetition. Why would you listen to a song 40 times? Why would you perform a play more than once? Unlike the sort of repressive logic of, say, abstinence, where there's virginity, right, and you lose it once and it's gone, you've used it up. The pleasure of creating a new version of the same story is that you get to do it as many times as you want. You know, Harry and Draco can have their first kiss 100,000 times from 100,000 authors, and it won't be used up. It'll still be the first kiss because it's not about exclusiveness. Moreover, that sort of overcommitment of creative energy is itself, it's a pleasure in excessiveness. The only reason to commit to something is to overcommit to it. That we don't enjoy ourselves, and we don't love other people in ways, or other things, in rational ways that, again, calculate out exactly how much you got from the other object in the relationship, and then give exactly that much back. And in fact, that would be an irrational thing to do. That's just not the way, you know, to live a happy life. Well, you know, that's a little irrational too. I've been looking at people's descriptions of writing in non-commercial spaces, and I actually intend to work on this project, and I think I'll find the same things for people who end up commercializing their work, is that the experience of creativity is powerful, consuming, like addiction. You see a lot of addiction metaphors. You know, people are completely consumed, distracted. The stories burn up my brain. I'm desperately in love. I have no perspective. Like falling in love at 15, that is one experience of creativity. And I don't want to say that it's the only experience of creativity or that it's something that you get without also sitting down and working, right? You sit at the computer until the words form in blood on your head. That is actually completely consistent with having an impulse to write. And there are all sorts of ways in which you can combine both rational and extra-rational, excessive motives for creating. But this is one way that creativity happens, and it's one that copyright has a very hard time evaluating. And the reason, then, that fan works seem like a good metaphor is that they foreground, or by a good prototype of fair use, they foreground that lack of scarcity in the creative economy. So, for example, there's a phenomenon called five things that never happen, where one author writes five connected stories, or at least physically connected, one after the other, involving five alternate scenarios for their favorite character, or their favorite show, or whatever. And they're usually inconsistent with each other. They're five things that never happened and could never happen in the same world. And it foregrounds the fact that these are completely non-exclusive, even though Kirk dies in one, lives in the other, gets married in the other, you know, and goes off with Spock in the other. Those are all things that never happen, but could, and can happen consistently with these other things because there's no canonical control. And that sort of absolute lack of scarcity, that it doesn't have to go one way, is in its essence what people say when they say that copyright isn't always necessary to get creative production. So the other thing that I think makes fanfiction very attractive for copyright scholars in particular is that it does have this seeming contradiction, though, you know, psychoanalysts will tell you that most contradictions are often in the subject, in the service of an underlying logic. The contradiction is that the underlying text is copyrighted, seems to have been produced in the Model 1. You know, we got the economic incentive to speak. How can you then go to that and say, okay, here we're gonna rely on that and borrow from that, and we want to take it out of the productive economy. And I think the answer to that is simply, first of all, is that there's plenty of that magic in works produced in Model 1. Absolutely. And that honoring that by responding to it creatively is one way that we keep those works alive as well, that we recognize them as different types of contributions to a gift economy. Something, as Lewis Hyde says in discussing the gift, that a good gift is one that goes over and above the relationship. So Harry Potter, in many ways, is worth more than $27, but it's not worth $45. It's worth $27 plus a creative component, an interaction between the author and the audience. And it's by responding creatively that we honor that part of it and keep it out of the market economy. Thank you.
In Chicago, and I'm feeling a little tired. So I wanted to first thank everyone here at Washington College of Law for inviting me to participate in a very wonderful conference today. I want to talk a little bit about my paper. It's the title, the working title now is Difference in Technology, Gender, Race, and Identity on the Internet. And I'll start out by preliminarily telling you that this comes more from my anthropology side than my legal side, and I'm moving it more in the direction of law. It actually continues some of the work I worked on in my dissertation, where I focused on images of Africa in Tarzan, novels, films, and comics. So in some ways, what I'm talking about comes out of that, and I'm bringing it into discussions of how we should think about images of gender and race on the internet today. So I'm going to try to talk about four things: technology and context, then talk about technology and difference, women's bodies, and then internet communities. And I'm going to try to not talk too quickly. I unfortunately did a fair number of slides for the amount of time I have, but I'll keep my eye on time so I don't go too far over. So first of all, talking about technology in context, a lot of times when we talk about technology, we make an assumption that technology is somehow related to progress. Technological progress makes our lives better in many ways, and in many respects that's true. I mean, I would say as an academic, it's much easier today to work with computers than it was in the days when we had to work with typewriters, for instance, and making copies. I mean, the digital world makes things a lot easier. But I think we need to sometimes step back and think about what assumptions we make when we think that technology is the same as progress, or that technology always involves progress. Certainly when we talk about technological progress, particularly in the latter half of the 20th century, we're talking about significant technological and scientific advancement on numerous levels. Now, what I'm interested in is stepping back and talking a little bit about the questions of context and meaning. So we have a lot of technological progress, but the question is, how does technology affect meaning and the choices or constraints we face on a daily basis? So how does technology really affect our lives, and what is the significance of technology on a broader level? So my focus is talking about, in this paper, is talking about the intersection between conceptions of technology and conceptualizations of difference. And when I say difference, I'm talking about human difference. So how do existing conceptions of difference play out in the internet context? Now, of course, I can only, in the time I have, really talk preliminarily about what kind of ideas I have about this topic, but I'm really going to try to focus a bit on the relationship between gender, race, and sexuality. Just going to first note that stereotypes are sets of mental representations we make about the world, and we all do it all the time and every day. It's an important part of how we organize the world mentally. It's a key element in distinguishing construction of who we are, ourselves, from what we might characterize as others. Now, gender, sexuality, and race are core differences around which conceptualization of the other is often constructed. So, one way to think about the others is reflecting patterns of inclusion and exclusion. So who is considered to be one of us, and who is actually included? So representations and images on the internet and in media and in other arenas they mark a zone. We can think of them as marking zones of inclusion and exclusion. So that's my background. So when we think about the internet context, I think an important question we have to ask ourselves, and I think today is a very important day to ask it because it's the 40th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King. So I think the question we might want to ask is, what kind of world do we envisage, not just today, but 10 or 15 years from now, on the internet with respect to the kind of issues that Martin Luther King Jr. focused on? And, you know, I would say there's a lot to be troubled about from that perspective. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some historical examples and then talk a little bit about things that are happening today. But I'm going to focus in my talk about images of women on the internet as well as conceptualizations of gender and race. And we've had a number of recent events in the last year in this sort of, we have auto admit, we have death threats against Kathy Sierra. We have a lot of discussions about images of women in rap music videos, for instance. And I'm not going to talk so much about those recent events. I'm going to talk a little bit more about historical background and then talk about some things that I find particularly troubling. So I'm going to talk about, how many people here have heard about the Hottentot Venus? So, a fair number of people. I like that. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the Hottentot Venus. Now this is continuing Anita Allen's Bottoms folklore. You had Bottoms in your video, so our continuity is, we're going to talk about Bottoms. Now, the Hottentot Venus, I'm going to show you a couple of drawings of her, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about who she was. This is a colored engraving by Jean-Baptiste Béret. It's a colored engraving on top, but you can't really see it. Sorry, the image is sort of small. On the bottom is a genital cartouche, and I'll tell you a little bit more about what that was all about. These are two more images from 1815, which is actually the year she died. And these are representations of her. I don't know. Can you actually see the pictures? Okay. So sorry, they're scans, so they're not so high quality. So that's a frontal shot and then a side shot by two European artists in 1815. So who was the person that we refer to as the Hottentot Venus? Her name was Sarpi, which is a diminutive of Sarah, Barsman. So this is what we do know about her. Her name is a diminutive. It's symbolic of both her colonial condition and her status. She was a member of the Khoisan peoples of South Africa. She was orphaned in colonial wars, orphaned and widowed apparently, and then became a slave. So she became a nursemaid for a family in Cape Town, in the Cape Colony. And she was taken to London to be exhibited in a cage for profit. She became a sensation. She became famous in Europe. In the short time of her life. She actually died when she was 26. In London, she was exhibited so people could see her protruding buttocks and fantasize about her exotic labia. In Paris, she was subject to public inspection by a team of scientists. And in Paris, she was later exhibited by an animal trainer. She became a prostitute and died in Paris in 1815 at age 26, an alcoholic from either respiratory disease or syphilis. After her death, her body was dissected by Georges Cuvier, the most famous French anatomist, and Cuvier removed her brain and labia and put them in jars, and they also kept her skeleton. They also took a full body cast of her body at the time of her death. Now, the jars were on display in Paris until as late as the 1970s. And the thing that's interesting about Sarah Bartman is that it took her 3 months to get to Europe and over 200 years to return home because her body ended up being returned to South Africa by France in 2002 after a very long battle. Nelson Mandela actually had raised, the minute South Africa, the ANC took over the government in South Africa, one of the first issues he raised was the return of her body. And it's a big issue in South Africa in particular. He raised the issue with François Mitterrand in 1994, and it took 8 years for her body to be returned. It was a big international controversy. So what are some of the things we don't know about Sarah Bartman? We don't actually know her real name. We just know the name that was the Dutch name that she was given. We don't actually know what her indigenous name was. So why is the Hottentot Venus important? I think she served as a central image for the black female throughout the 19th century. She served as an example of African primitivity and sexuality. Now, we might think 1815 is a really long time ago. Now, President Thabo Mbeki today, there's continuing relevance of this issue today on a number of different levels. President Thabo Mbeki has said, the story of Sarah Bartman is the story of the African peoples, the African people of our country in all their echelons. So her story is taken as a symbolic story of the importance of the experience of African peoples in the 19th century. However, I think when we think about the Sarah Bartlett story, I think her relevance is certainly not limited to the 19th century. Images and representations of Sarah Bartlett served as a marker for the zones of exclusion and inclusion, the demarcation of the other and self. So who are we and who are these others? Now, the particular zone of exclusion in Sarah Bartlett's case was the human race. Exhibitions and images of Sarah Bartlett were made available in a world where she was not thought of as human. Now, if you think about the scientific theory of the time, there was scientific support at that time for the idea that African peoples weren't human. Polygenism, there was an idea that she was a member of a different and certainly inferior race. And that those assumptions underlie how she was treated and how the images and representations of her carried forth. Now, as Patricia Hill Collins has noted, she said Bartlett was used as a pornographic object, similar to how women are represented in contemporary pornography. Although she's far removed in time, in certain ways, we have representations of women where women are objectified. Sarah Bartlett was essentially reduced to her body parts, the most important body parts being her bottom and her labia. So now the question is, what is the significance of that today in the internet context today? Now, in the internet context today, I think as Anne Bartow has written about extensively, pornography is pervasive. 12% of the total of all internet websites, 25% of all daily search engine requests, 35% of all monthly peer-to-peer downloads. From a gender context, we have pervasive abuses and threats of women bloggers, for instance. From a race ethnicity perspective, we have a lot of invisibility of racial and ethnic minorities on the internet and significant racial stereotyping. So the question that I would leave you with, my short presentation, is what views of humanity of the other are most evident on the internet? And what are the current implications? What are the significance and meaning of the images of others that we see on the internet today? And what are the implications for the future? If we are truly moving toward this new world, brave new world, where technology is increasingly central and increasingly pervasive, what are the zones of exclusion and inclusion that we're demarcating today? And how can we, thinking about bringing this back to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., how can we make sure that the vision of the world that he had in mind 40 years ago is going to carry through in this new technologically oriented world? And I think I will, in 5 minutes, I'll do a couple more slides. Okay, I think in general we could benefit from greater attention to questions of meaning and context when we talk about technology. How are we creating zones of inclusion and exclusion? And when we think about internet communities, what kind of worlds are we really building on the internet? And really think about moving in the internet towards thinking about the internet as a zone of inclusion and what that requires from the perspective of internet communities. And I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like first to thank Claire Phillips for having invited me here, and also Dan Burke, who has, I think, heard my name a few times ago, saying you should invite us. I'm really, really honored to be here with you. Maybe I would like first to situate the place from where I'm looking. I'm talking because I'm a lawyer predominantly, so my speech will be really related to my education as a lawyer and my practice as a lawyer. And also, I've been educated in law from a Western perspective, so that means a lot of things, especially in intellectual property, as you might know. And I'm also European, as you might have noticed from my bad accent in English. And that means also that coming from Europe, my vision of copyright and patent law might be slightly different than yours. So maybe we have other concepts at some point. So maybe in the discussion we might have some not misunderstandings, but maybe some clarification would be needed. And also in Europe, women and gender studies, unfortunately, are really, really poor and are really difficult to get in university. And also we have a very strong positivist view of law. So it means that we are really not accustomed to mix gender and law, and not only mixed gender and IP. So it's really a new perspective for me, but I found it very, very interesting, and I really would like to continue in that field. I would also like to apologize for the paper. You have received my paper. It's really, really a draft paper. I had to write it very quickly for many reasons, and when I reread it a few days ago, I noticed that there were so many errors left and footnotes missing, so apologize me for that. Okay, so, and I have only 15 minutes, and I don't talk as quickly as you do in English. I'll have to speed up my speech. For the last 2 years, I've been working a lot on the public domain issue in copyright and in patent law, and so I decided to take this conference as an opportunity to look at the public domain issue from a gender perspective, and actually it proved very interesting. My objective in my public domain research has always been to, as many others I suppose, has been to develop some strategies to try to safeguard the public domain from being encroached upon, as it is increasingly today, and also to see what public domain currently is in copyright and patent laws, and maybe try to devise what it should be to make it stronger and maybe more important in our IP regime. So my starting point in the last 2 years has been to analyze the public domain and the role it plays in copyright and patent laws. And surprisingly, even though there is a strong emphasis on public domain in the IP discourse of today, public domain is not even mentioned in the law, or it's rarely mentioned in the laws. And there is no reference in the law to public domain, there is no legal definition of the public domain in the laws, and there is no legal rules attached to the public domain. The common definition we have of the public domain is the fact that public domain is comprising all the elements that are not protected by copyright or patent, or they are no more protected by copyright or patent. So the definition we have of the public domain is only a negative definition starting from what is property. So public domain is the no property, it's the no copyright, the no patent. And so that really instills a sort of dualism in intellectual property between the property characterized by exclusivity, exclusive rights, exclusion, and the public domain that is not really characterized by any feature, any specific feature, it's only defined as the other, as the no property, no exclusion. And this dualism, of course, is really interesting because I think it's really the source of the problem with the public domain, that is, that for the moment, we know that there is a public domain, but we can't know how long it will survive, and we don't know how we can preserve it from commodification, from appropriation. And I think the problem is that because we have this negative definition of the public domain, we consider the public domain as a wasteland where everybody can go and help herself and take something to commodify, to make it into a copyrightable or patentable product. And I think this is a very key issue in public domain. So my purpose was to try to reverse that negative definition and to build a sort of positive definition and status for the public domain. So when I look to that point with a gender perspective, of course I read a lot of papers that have been written for that conference along the years, and other papers also. And what struck me was that it seems that when looking at intellectual property with a gender perspective, the dualism between public domain and intellectual property aligns itself with the gender dualism we know about men defined as the subject and women as defined as the other. A lot of papers I read before coming to the conference seem to put female creation as unprotected, so in the public domain, and seems to make masculine creation the focus of intellectual property. There are many reasons for that that I found in your papers, the papers by others. There are of course some notions in copyright or patent law, such as the notion of authorship, that is based on patriarchal bias. There are also the fact that in the history, the women have not had the same access than men to artistic creation or to science, to technical inventions. And even if they were inventors, there are many examples throughout history where female inventions made by women were actually registered by their husbands, who was their name as the inventors in the patent that was granted. And also, there are a lot of creations or inventions that are specifically female, such as quilts, cooking methods, and everything, that were not considered as either original enough or technical enough to be copyrightable or patentable. There is also on an international scale, the fact that, and the WIPO has made a lot of study in that field recently, the fact that if you look at traditional knowledge of folklore, it seems that this traditional knowledge of folklore is mostly transmitted and safeguarded by women. So that means that if our system of IP don't protect traditional knowledge and folklore as we do for Western type of creation, then we don't protect female creation. And the WIPO has started to do a lot of things towards women in indigenous culture to make them aware of the IP system out there. So for all these reasons, it seems that the female creation has less opportunity to get access to intellectual property and is more likely to fall into the public domain, to be in the public domain. So it seems to be like IP would be masculine, the public domain would be feminine. So it reinforces and genders the dualism we know in IP between the public domain and property. And of course, women know well about such dualism, and they have deployed a lot of strategy to overcome this dualism between gender that has excluded them. And I think that some strategy that women have deployed have been used also in IP to make public domain more relevant in the discourse. The first strategy would be to try to conquer the field where the subject is valued the most. So for instance, women have tried to conquer what they considered as being the male territory. And the same has happened in intellectual property. For instance, with traditional knowledge, a lot of propositions we have today to protect traditional knowledge are based predominantly on Western ideas of intellectual property. So we want to grant traditional knowledge some intellectual property rights that are based on our pattern of IP. So that means, I have a problem with that, because that means that we don't take the opportunity to take other type of creation to challenge the legal regime we have built around a certain notion of creation, but we try to incorporate them into our concept of intellectual property. So we make that as a colonialism, maybe, of IP. We try really to make the IP system, as we know, as the universalizing system for protecting creation and culture. And that makes me an atheist. And on the other side, they might have another perspective, another strategy that has been deployed. It's not to conquer the male territory or the IP territory, but trying to contest its authority. And intellectual property, we have seen a lot of creators that have challenged the notion of authorship, the notion of originality, the notion of maybe less in pattern, but the notion of what is a copy, what is infringement. And unsurprisingly enough, a lot of these artists did appropriation art were female artists and feminist artists like Sherry Levine or Hélène Sturtevant. So it's really interesting to see that women have tried to contest the authority in copyright. And in the technological world, it has happened again around open source software and other open access schemes where you have a lot of creators who have tried to challenge the discourse around IP, the incentive discourse that justify the IP system and have tried to change the exclusivity into a sharing ideology. And in that field also, they have a lot of feminists, a lot of women who have tried to be guided by this ideology of sharing, and I know that Laurence Rassel will talk to you about that. I also have a problem with that strategy because for me it seems that I promote open access, don't get me wrong. I think it's really important in IP to have open access also. But I think that reacting to the exclusion you can feel as artist, because even with your IP, you're not rewarded enough. This is not a myth in IP that IP is a reward, isn't a reward. If you ask too many artists, it's not a reward at all. So it seems to me that if, bec- because they can't get enough remuneration from their creation, they will get into a gift economy. It seems to me that it could be similar to the care economy, where women were imposed a gift to their family or to their society, and without being paid or without being paid sufficiently. So I think that in open access, I could be very long on that topic, so I will leave it for question. But I think in open access, we really also should have assess the cost of the open access economy on the individuals who will get into that economy, because that economy is not imposed on Microsoft. Is imposed on people who want to go into that sharing ideology. So for me, I think that neither strategy really affects dualism or challenge it. And in my paper, I started, but I'm not finished yet, to try another strategy. And my other strategy would be complementary to the others, maybe, would be to see to the... to queer theory or the work of Janice Butler in the way she has troubled the dualism by not trying to make women into men or men into women, but the way she has tried to understand what was the relationship between men and women and how it was constructed against each other. And I think we should do the same with the public domain and intellectual property, to see, to understand that they are not so different, they are more intertwined, and they are each one of them is constructed against the other, and is also there is this relationship between the two poles of this dualism. So applying that methodology into intellectual property for me would be done in two steps, and still I have 2 minutes, I have 1 minute per step. So the first one would be to deconstruct what seems so natural in intellectual property and public domain. It seems we are being told that public domain is what is not protected, and it's so an inherent truth, but it's not. It's really performative. The IP law are really performative in allocating property to some resources and excluding some other resources and making them fall into the public domain. It's not natural. Originality, novelty, inventorship, ownership are not natural, of course. They are really normative criteria that operate in a way that fills some economic needs. And one good example is that even though we think that copyright is fixed and our patent law works on fixed criteria, along the years we have seen an expansion of copyright and patent law to some new resources that were relevant for markets, just like biotechnology, databases in Europe, computer software, business method, all those things that we could have thought 30 years ago that they would never enter into copyright or patent arenas because they were not fit to comply with the requirements for protection. And 30 years later, because there was a market demand, we have accommodated our criteria to make them enter in the field. And so there is this performative function within intellectual property. And this performative function is also relevant for public domain, because a lot of things we put into the public domain is not because those things are so culturally or socially important that everybody wants should be able to benefit from it. No, it's not. It's because we want the market to benefit from that freedom to copy. So at some point, the market has a need to freedom of copy something, and that makes those things into the public domain. And traditional knowledge is a very good example of that. We put traditional knowledge in public domain so we can help Western company to come and take and make that into commodities that then would be copyrightable and patentable. So it's not so natural. The other thing is that the view we have about the public domain is really fallacious, because we think the public domain is a sort of separate place. And the terminology we use to describe public domain is also very relevant here. We see it's a domain, so it's really separated half from the domain of property. It's separate, maybe contiguous, but separate. And it's public, so it means that it's for the public, but actually it's not the way public domain works. Public domain is not separate, it's intertwined with property most of the time. And also it's not public. Yes, it's public in the way that you can come and get something, one stand as a public thing. It's public available, but it's not public. It's not reserved for the public, and a lot of things in the public domain can be commodified and can be transformed into copyrighted and patented assets. So I think that understanding the way it works, public domain compared to intellectual property, we can see that if it is performative, we can also put in place other maybe performative notions and norms to travel that relationship and to make public domain more valuable into the regime of intellectual property. Since I don't have much time, maybe I will focus on one of my projects in that querying methodology of public domain in intellectual property. I've written an article about it in Copyright. My idea was to maybe try to give a status to public domain, so to make public domain enter into the intellectual property laws by defining public domain in the laws and by giving it a regime that would preserve it from commodification. My proposition would be to use the concept that we know in the French Civil Code. So maybe it's a bit remote from here, but maybe not. And the French Civil Code knows the notion of commons, or bien commun, and it is defined, commons are things that are owned by nobody, and whose use is common to all. So these two parts, the first part is commons are owned by nobody. It is the public domain as we know it today. But we can make it more normative, and I think there are a lot of if we look at the history of the provision, it's not only commons are things that are not owned by anybody, but things that should not be owned by anybody. So it means that we should really enforce a rule of prohibition to reconstitute a monopoly over the public domain, either by an extension of the copyright duration, or by the fact that once a work has fallen into a public domain, we can reconstitute monopoly by a trademark vested in that work. And we should enforce that rules that would prohibit some overlapping of intellectual property rights. And there are some case law in Europe starting to do that, building on the public domain notion. And the second part of this commons definition is that the use of the commons should be common to all. And that means that, of course, there is a freedom to copy, but it means also that there is a sort of obligation of conservation to make this commons use very effective. So, of course, in intellectual property, conservation doesn't make much sense. It's not like preservation of natural reserve, but this obligation of conservation would be transformed into an obligation of effective availability and effective accessibility of public domain resources. So that would lay an obligation on, I don't know who, or some states or government, to really make what is into the public domain really available to all. So this is the first step of my program. Thank you.
Wonderful. So I've been asked to spend a couple of minutes. Make a few comments about what might otherwise seem a pretty diverse panel of papers. Paper about using gendered fan fiction slash fiction as a window into the economic dysfunctions of our copyright system. Paper about racial and sexual differences in technology and ICTs. Paper about reconceiving the public domain by using methodologies that recognize and reject the dualisms. I think I'm right. And looking for the commonalities in these papers, the thing that struck me first about them was that it seems to me, aside from there being very thoughtful and sophisticated, it seems to me these are exactly the kinds of papers, the kinds of scholarship that I believe Peter and Anne and Anne Bartow hoped would emerge, hoped would develop when they began this series of conferences and workshops 5 years ago. Certainly, it's the kind of scholarship that I had envisioned emerging when I began to dabble in this area. And so I wanted to think about papers from that standpoint. What is it about them that makes them that kind of scholarship, what is about them that we hope, I hope, will be emulated in future projects that people here and elsewhere will undertake. And I think about that to some extent from a Zen standpoint, as a sort of a feminist koan. Now, some of you who know something about Zen know that a koan is a little story or dialogue that on its face looks paradoxical or impossible. This is a good example. Classic one. A monk asked Dongshan Shaochu, "What is Buddha?" Dongshan said, 3 pounds of flax." And on his face, that looks paradoxical or nonsensical. The idea of the koan is to startle the mind, to cause a type of reflection that brings you out of sort of the everyday, commonplace, conventional thinking, particularly dualistic thinking that you might do, and startle you or move you into a state of enlightenment, into Satori. And I think of feminist scholarship and other critical perspectives, queer theory, critical race theory, as doing very much the same sort of thing for us, right? Sort of moving us out of business as usual, startling us or confronting us with what seems like a conundrum or a paradox, and moving us to think about things in a different way. And in fact, I find that people react to feminist and critical approaches in very much the way that a lot of people react to the koan. Should we really take that seriously? I once had a student say that to me. I assigned Leslie Bender's paper on gender and torts, the reasonably prudent person or reasonable man standard for class. And I had a student, a young man came to me at the class and said, should I take this seriously? I said, well, you know, it was assigned in class and it could show up on the test. Fire, you might take it pretty seriously. So you get that same kind of reaction. And as was said last night at the dinner, you get that from the discussion of IP and gender. Now people say, well, we should take that seriously. Maybe get a little bit less than we did 5 years ago, but we still get that. So thinking about it in that way is sort of moving us from business as usual. Here are the kinds of things that, you know, we usually do in intellectual property and technology scholarship. Right? These are very familiar metrics that Rebecca has identified and that Sylvain has talked about. We ask things like, does the intellectual property regime promote the progress of science and useful arts? Right? That's straight out of the United States Constitution. Does the intellectual property regime prompt investment? Right? Does it incentivize or incent innovation? Does it get people to invest in creation? Does the regime reward the labor of creators? And maybe from a moral rights perspective, does respect the authorship or the person for the creator. Does the intellectual property regime benefit the public, right? Again, something that both Severine and to some extent Rebecca talked about. And those are the kinds of questions that we usually ask, right? These papers, I think, are a shift, right? And I think other papers in the conference are as well, because it moves us away from, confronts us with problems and paradoxes that move us away from asking those kinds of questions. So what kinds of questions, you know, are sort of latent in these papers? What kind of questions do I think we ought to be asking or that we might continue to ask in the future? Well, I'm drawing very explicitly here on work by Devalina Roy and Bonnie Spanier, trying to operationalize the insights of feminist critiques and critical perspectives. Spanier says, feminist research originates in the material and political concerns of women-centered efforts to improve the quality of life for women, children, and hence the planet. Women's concerns about what is wrong with society, such as violence, poverty, and sexual abuse, and the misuse of power over people and resources, are placed at the center of feminist research. Right? You heard a good deal of that concern in Fumi's presentation. So instead of asking those questions we saw on the last slide that we usually ask, maybe we should ask questions, as I think these papers do. For example, does the intellectual property regime originate in the material and political concerns of women-centered efforts to improve the quality of life for those who are oppressed? Right? That's a very different kind of question about how successful our intellectual property regime is than the ones you saw on the last slide. Turning back to Bonnie Spanish, she says, originating in concerns for women's quality of life, a central purpose in feminist inquiry is to eliminate constraints based on, say, sex, race, class, sexual orientation, and other arbitrary categories in order to change society for the better. You heard some of that, I think, in our keynote speech from Anita Allen. Identifying bias in language, concepts, paradigms, and applications in personal policies of the law acknowledges the harm done to people in society by studies and by regimes based on questionable assumptions about the meaning of gender, race, and sexual orientation. Right? That's sort of linked in all of these papers. So we might ask questions like this. Is the central purpose of the intellectual property regime that we're looking at, or the doctrines we're looking at, to eliminate constraints based on gender in order to change society for the better? Particularly, I think, appropriate in a program sponsored by Center for the Study of Intellectual Justice and Women's Studies. We could ask, does the intellectual property regime that we are looking at improve the quality of life for people by eliminating or eschewing inaccuracies and distortions of biased paradigms? And I think you heard some of that being asked in these papers. So those are research questions that are a little bit different than those we asked in the past. Back to Spania. She says, feminism turns to a broader and more interdisciplinary range of knowledge and theories for explanation and forms of evidence, taking into account cross-cultural and intercultural evidence for the plasticity of human behavior and physicality. And you've heard some of those concerns, I think, in all the papers, particularly in Flumi's, thinking about the dynamics of culture and other cultural approaches. So we might ask a question like, does the intellectual property regime that we're studying reflect the dynamics of culture that shape behavior and institutions? And then, I didn't see this so much in the papers, but it's very interesting that came out in Severine's introduction to her presentation. Spanier says, one of the tenets of feminist scholarship is that the researcher should be in the same critical plane as the subject matter. And you heard Severine sort of tell you about her standpoint and the perspective that she was bringing to bear on her research. So we might ask the question, does the critique that we're engaged in of the regime demonstrate a transparent conceptual framework that places the researcher on a mutual footing with the subject matter? And I think all these papers ask questions along these lines. I think we'll hear the other papers today ask questions along these lines, which are, as I said, not business as usual. They're not the kinds of questions that we tend to ask about intellectual property and intellectual property regimes. Let me you know, sort of give you, in the couple of minutes I have left, an example of the methodology from these papers, how it might be applied going forward, or how some things that we find in the papers might be considered. So, you know, I mentioned at the beginning, we often ask, does the intellectual property regime we have promote progress in science and the useful arts? One of the striking things about Funmi's presentation, and it comes out even more in the full text of the paper if you look at it, is this idea of what is progress, right? Sort of technological deterministic idea of progress is faster and bigger and sort of more elaborate. And we might question whether that is really what we want progress to mean. In thinking that way, and I take a page from Catherine McKinnon. Remember, she very famously argued that equality, you know, equal protection in the U.S. Constitution and elsewhere, shouldn't mean what we've usually traditionally thought that it should mean, that equal things or similarly situated things should be treated in the same way. She argued instead that we ought to look at that differently to achieve a particular goal, right? We ought to talk about equality or equal protection as interpreted so as to lessen the power disparities, right, between people in society. Didn't get a lot of traction with that in the United States, but she actually got a fair amount of response from the Canadian Supreme Court interpreting the Canadian Charter, the idea of equality along those lines. Maybe we need to do the same thing with our constitutional concept of progress, right? I mean, as Funmi points out, maybe progress doesn't mean, you know, faster, bigger, more elaborate. Maybe it doesn't even mean what Amala Pollock has found, you know, that historically it meant dissemination or spreading of knowledge. Maybe we need to think about progress in terms of the kinds of questions I've just identified, right? You know, do we have a good intellectual property regime? Are we having progress in science and useful arts if we're eliminating bias through the intellectual property regime, if we are creating access through the intellectual property regime, if we are addressing disparities in the different classifications that we created. Now, maybe that's not what the founders had in mind. You know, if you're sort of an original intent person, that might bother you. You might have to move to something more like Lessig's translation idea, that we sort of take what progress might have meant at one time and try and translate that into what it ought to mean today, and think about progress in the ways that I think these papers identify, the methodology these papers identify, rather than business as usual, rather than the conventional paradigms we've used to progress. So that's what I see these writers as doing. I think we're going to see some more of that in the conference today. And I want to open things up now for questions and comments to the panelists. Questions for any of our speakers? Yeah.
Actually, I thought it was an incredibly coherent panel, in that for me, as I was listening to all of this, it seemed to me that many of these papers turn on essentially two binaries, one of which is amateur versus professional, and I kept hearing Rebecca's presentation, the amare is amateur, right? And the extent to which the love of the love that is embedded in amateurism, right, is on some level a gendered thing, and how do we treat those who love, right, or are taken as sort of how as objects of love? And then when, you know, putting that against the binary of professionalism to the last point, we're sort of saying, does that mean then condemning women potentially always to amateur status, right? Which is the opposite. On the one hand, right, wanting to construct a place of respect for the amateur, and thinking that, you know, that the idea of incentivizing creation is, I mean, it's kind of ironic that intellectual property is kind of proposed by Wordsworth, right? And this sort of school of romantic poets who were of this kind of creative expressivist model of creativity, right? I mean, the landscape, and also the landscape poets, which I think are sort of interesting for public domain, right? People who were inspired by, right, walking through the Lake District, right? And there's a sort of connection on this intellectual property and the sort of, you know, 19th century poets who proposed it. And so the sense that love, right, everybody creates for love first, and then you get paid, right? And there seems to be some uniquely gendered way in which creating for love, you know, is marked in this society, and whether or not women then can ever get right paid, right? That there's some sense that you don't want to condemn women to only being amateurs by valuing their love, right? So that seems to be one of the things. And then obviously the public-private issue, right, the sense in which we don't value the public, right, to the extent that the public is female, we don't value the public more generally anyway, right? It seems to me that there's a lot underlying this conversation about how we think about whether it's public space, public library, public television, right, or public toilets. Is the public a place that is not valued, or is the public a place for fertile, the word that comes to mind this summer is maybe the word I want, fertile sharing and other kinds of things. So actually, I felt like I heard these concerns across all three papers.
Authors, Rebecca, somebody respond?
I understand your point of view, but I'm not sure that I would divide the issue between amateur and professional, because I think that, let me take two examples, where feminist artists were challenging the notion of authority, of authorship, of copyright, of copy, original, and things like that, they were professional. Mm-hmm. But and they were not taking a stance of amateurship, they were taking a stance where maybe the authorship that was already discussed in aesthetics by Foucault and Barthes could also be integrated into the practice in a different way. But unfortunately enough, the copyright regime, as we know, was rather close to that reflection and could not integrate within its field the maybe another notion of authorship that would make amateur, professional, maybe compete with each other, and also professional being able to play outside of the copyright regime and to be able to allow for amateur to play inside the regime, I think. My other example is in open access and open source software, where actually the problem was that the strategy that was deployed by open access proponents, either in Creative Commons or the GPL and things like that, was that they wanted to make their works into the public domain. Maybe not all of them, but mostly. But actually the lack of a definition of a regime for the public domain means that if they put their works into the public domain, it was free for others to take and be rewarded for it. So the open access strategy was to use the intellectual property regime to make it a public domain, but with an exclusion tool. And this is one of the problems of an open access regime, is that it relies solely on tools in the intellectual property, such as contract licenses and sometimes technological measures or some sort of, that that build they are one of the problems that they try to defeat in the intellectual property. So it means that they were professionals, and for professionals, maybe I concur with you in the fact that as professionals, the only tools they have at their disposal were tools elaborated by the copyright or patent regimes, and those tools were not allowing freedom, so they twisted their tools to allow for more sharing and freedom to use. But at the same time, it was a strategy, and it's still a strategy that works on copyright and patent law premises, and it's also a strategy that is completely voluntary. So open access is good, I think, of course, but it won't challenge intellectual property itself. It's only open to the people who want to do that, but it's not, so it doesn't infuse into the intellectual property some more freedoms. It's only a free choice, if you want. So I think this is a key issue, and I think that open access is one strategy, but at the same time, we have to deploy other strategy, more normative ones that would bring public domain and freedom to copy within the intellectual property regime, both for amateur and for professionals.
Okay, so I'm going to take this in a slightly different direction. So, and this is something I keep thinking about, which is, so we have the critique of equality, feminism, or IP, which, you know, giving us what the guys have. It has real problems. And then we have the critique of difference feminism or IP, which is, you know, not paying us has real problems. Right. So then there are obviously two big schools in feminist thought that I would identify. Say there's Kathleen McKinnon, we've heard about, saying, you know, it's about power. So let's hand out power. And I keep trying to figure out what the dominance version of IP would be like, and it's not clear to me that it's possible to have a dominance version of IP because, you know, the power seems to be elsewhere, right? That dominance feminism works a lot better when you have an entire field of policy to work on, and you can say, okay, let's move the power around, you know, wherever we need to move it. And I consistently run up against this difficulty in figuring out what IP should be doing in that. Then the Judith Butler alternative, I admit, you know, I'm inherently less sympathetic to it, but I'm certainly willing to hear more about it and how it might be implemented. I mean, it seems to me that the problem with Butler type analysis is always in translating them into, you know, well, what do you want me to do? And of course, that is the law professor question, you know, par excellence, what is the payoff? And so I would love to hear more about whether, you know, there is a Butlerian way around this. And I actually, and I mean, so I was thinking whether you might have something to say about that. I mean, my reaction to the Hottentot Venus is, you know, that's a moment where Kathryn McKinnon comes before and says, look, you know, forget about social construction and deconstructing binaries, get her home. Right. That, you know, do justice, and then tell me about, you know, how she was used to represent stuff. But you may have more to say.
I don't know. I mean, this raises an interesting issue because I think IP is both over-inclusive and under-inclusive at the same time. It's under-inclusive to the extent that groups that have historically been conceptualized as other, their production hasn't been protected. But I think we all agree that IP is way too over-inclusive today on a lot of levels. So how you sort of mediate between that over-inclusivity and under-inclusivity is, I think, at the core of what we're talking about. And I'm not sure there are easy answers, because I also write in the traditional knowledge area. And I think many would agree that there's a lot of stuff that constitutes traditional knowledge that's not protected solely for historical reasons related to power. Power and who wrote the laws. I mean, after all, remember, it's not necessarily that women's creativity is different, it's that men wrote the laws. So this sort of over-inclusive and under-inclusive at the same time, I think makes it difficult to sort of mediate between those two issues.
I love the way Rebecca just framed that in terms of different feminisms and where to go. And I think that one of the things I was taking out of the panel, I love also Dan's framing of a set of concerns that united these in some ways different but also very coherent presentations about access, distortion, bias, and a sense of justice or normative categories that are emerging in those things. But the other way I was, there were two other ways I was looking at it that come out of feminism, and it's this also in the papers with the challenges to dichotomies, which we saw over and over again, the challenges to the public-private dichotomy, the challenge to the market-family dichotomy, and how those two different dichotomies play in different, the public-private and the market-family, because it's market-public or it's market-private, and And then this other sort of the queering notion of sexuality and being an important theoretical engine, like in Janet Haley's work, to challenge these other dichotomies and say, well, you know, even these other challenges to these other dichotomies and the ambiguities of them doesn't quite work unless you do some queering of things. Which is not exactly Judith Butler. I mean, Janet Haley kind of brings a more mapping notion to the project, I think, than just the mapping of what's happening is an important conceptual tool to be engaging in, which then brings me back to the presentations, which is the notion of multiple readings, which we saw in Anita's introduction to the new readings and the importance of these other readings of Two Life Crew, which has kind of become like this big standard thing that has these standard readings in IP courses that people get, and her infusion of new readings into those, which makes me think that we are not at a McKinnon place of having an answer, but we're at a McKinnon place of, and maybe this is either like continuing to engage in changing mappings of things, or your notion of strategic intervention, like open source is not an answer, but it's a strategic intervention that takes us someplace without a notion that it is an answer in and of itself. It is a thing to do in terms of a law professor, a thing to protect, a thing to that is part of it, Severine's notion of some way to get at defining, giving meaning to the public domain without colonizing it, without completely defining what its boundaries are or its norm. So it leaves us in a terribly tentative place, but perhaps that's where we are. I mean, I don't know other people's thoughts on it.
Do you want to jump in?
I agree with everything you've said, except, you know, we also have this activist role, which is, you know, what do we do now? So, although we always want to be revising, fans get cease and desist letters, right? I have to do something for them. I'm struck by this idea of consciousness raising, right? That what McKinnon describes as sort of you go to people and ask them, so what are you thinking about this, right? And there is too little of that. Creative Commons is a way of reaching out and actually sort of saying to people, you know, here, think about what you want out of IP. And I think that is a good idea, although it does end up with these consequences that you talk about. I don't think the problem is we've had a huge expansion in the number of people who are affected by IP. We all know that, and we have very little information about what they do with that. And you know, at most we get focus groups.
Well, but you know, this is maybe where having a clinic here and having projects come out of the clinic helps, because I'm thinking of the cease and desist letters, and I'm thinking of the project that Peter has been working on around taking fair use and actually making it something not just defensive, but using concepts of fair use to affirmatively create protected spaces for people in very contextualized, grounded ways. And then having students actually use those in particular cases to continue to expand those spaces through the use of law based on some of these intuitions that are coming at, more than intuitions, but statement of theories coming out of your notions of what's creative, protecting particular communities, what they think, going to those communities, then it really does come out in real questions like cease and desist letters and who can use what images in what films they're making. So I think that the tentativeness doesn't leave us necessarily powerless as lawyers or as teachers, but with a sense of that each thing we try will continue to have some contradictions in it that we will continue to have to confront.
Peter, you look like you're about to say something.
No, I was thinking, actually I had a snide comment about William Wilson, but I'll save it.
No,
I won't. I mean, just as a footnote to what Francesca said before, the other thing that's great about Wordsworth is that it turns out that all of these unmediated reflections on nature, not all, that's an overstatement, but lots of them, are directly cribbed from his sister Dorothy's private journal. And made the other points better.
And Barton has.
Yeah, I just thought it's a really short question, and I'm left. For Rebecca, which is, what about model one as the dominance, and then model two, or at least some author as this woman?
I guess when I say dominant feminism, I mean what would be the prescription and perhaps if the prescription would then be, you know, no more copyright, and that would certainly decrease the relative power of, you know, the controlling cultural industries. But it seems less likely to mean that, you know, the adoption of sexual harassment law, I don't want to get rid of, you know, the economic rewards to creativity. I want to try to figure out how to balance them, but yeah, everybody does, and it's real hard.
Steve, how are we doing on our schedule?
We're fine. We're just 5 minutes over, so we're fine.
Kitchen?
Yeah, this is a great panel. I wanted to say, first of all, I love the way you framed it, Dan, in trying to examine this problem. I mean, I think you...
Ian's got the mic.
You indicated that this is a fairly new enterprise, and you're right, people have not known, I think, where to exactly put this, but I think increasingly we're seeing how important it is, the whole project, IP reform, you know, what's on the table. IP system is a mess now, obviously, in a lot of different ways. I was thinking about the public domain, and I like Severin, how you said that the public domain is socially constructive. I think that's one of the insights of feminist theory into intellectual property. Generally, I think these critical perspectives are great because they really focus us on looking at not business as usual, but how things have real impact on people. And when you were talking about that, what I thought was that, okay, subordinated people, typically what they create is in the public domain, like, so African-Americans, jazz, flute in the public domain, not protective, women's work, you know, across the wide spectrum, traditional knowledge. But then, when the public domain is applied to these people, it seems to be applied in a way that negatively impacts them. So I'm thinking about, you know, rap music, right? We have a crackdown on mashups, on, you know, use of this type of artistic production. So I'm wondering what you would do. Would you consider maybe just scrapping the whole thing? Because it seems like subordinated peoples get the worst of all worlds. They get, you know, nothing in the public domain. Everything they get is in the public domain. And yet their creations are negatively impacted by the public domain. Well, we can't have mashups. That's not in the public domain. This is copyrighted material that we're dealing with. So I wonder if you thought at all about that. It seems like there's no, you were talking about compromises, but it seems like there's really no easy solutions except to start over. The more I think about this, maybe that's the best.
I would not advocate to start over, but I know that it's not easy. Actually, I didn't have time to go into details, but first I should have said maybe that my definition of public domain would not be only what is not protected by copyright or patent, but it could also include fair use and, you know, and using the notion of public domain as an operative notion that would include what is characterized by an absence of exclusivity. So that means that it could be a river use also. So it would mean that something might be protected, but they could allow for a use by other persons. And using a positive notion of the public domain would also help to maybe make fair use immune from some technological measures, contract prohibition, and things like that. So I don't really answer your questions by saying that, but I think that, of course, I wouldn't like the public domain become a sort of another preserve contiguous to the IP where you have rules of prohibition, even if it would be a prohibition to exclude. So I think that, of course, it would be, it should be a set of rules that would really try to make effective the freedom of using some other stuff. And it could be stuff that are not protected by IP, it could be stuff that would be protected by IP, but under some circumstances it would be a fair use. And my difficulty maybe is because since I come from Europe where we don't have a notion of fair use, we have a notion of exception that are strictly limited and they are strictly contextualized, so we know in what context we can make that type of use, even though we have some balancing criteria within those exceptions. So maybe my notion of fair use might be a bit strange to you, because there could be some uses that would be defined and determined priorly. But I understand your fear. This is also I explained my theory of making a positive public domain a few weeks ago, and there were a lot of activists in the room. They were not lawyers, they were open software activists, and most of them told me that this is very dangerous what you propose, because once we fix things, then you exclude, and then you... So I completely see your point, and I saw their point too, but for instance, for the moment, there is this big discussion at the WIPO about treaty for limitation and exceptions, and you had the same problems that some people said, okay, but if we go in that road and say we should have a mandatory list of exceptions, that it could freeze the old freedoms we might have in using protecting things. And I think this is a problem. So my response would not be a fixed status, but something that would maybe has fair use, a sort of criteria that could be also, that could evolve also. Because for cultural practice will change.
I'm betting we can get one more question. Yes, Anita, please.
I have two very brief questions/comments. One for two of the panelists. First question is about the cotton beans, and
I'm not sure that's working, so you might have to speak loud.
Okay. Turn on.
Cotton type beans. There we go. Yeah.
So how do you think about that that problem of the turning the African woman into an object of spectacle in light of the contemporary focus on the butt? So as you were talking, I was thinking about this rap song, which you probably don't know because you have teenagers at home, but Baby's Got Back, do you know that song?
I may know it. I write about hip-hop, so I do listen to it.
Right. So the lyrics, just for those of you who don't know, just quickly, I like big butts.
Yeah.
I like big butts. I cannot lie, and you other brothers can't deny. Because and this is a song which, you know, little 11-year-old girls dance around to as well. So there's this acceptance as part of mainstream culture now, the image of the big black butt. And so I'm sort of wondering, how can you in this moment, right, offer your analysis using the Hottentot Venus as the sort of model of problematic imagery when you're in a context in which the big black butt is a mainstream image. And then for Rebecca, my question is, have you thought about the connection between non-commercial creativity and mental illness? Because excessive spilling out, the writing as non-commercial, is the writing that's a product of mania. I don't know if you know the work of Dr. Kay Redfield Jameson, but she writes about the connection between creativity and bipolar illness. And she documents that many, many, many of our most creative writers, including the the romantic poets and so forth. Many, many have been people with bipolar disorder. And so how do you think about creativity in a non-commercial context? If it turns out that, as a matter of fact, a lot of that passion for writing and passion for creating comes from a pathological space.
I think if you think of the butt obsession, if you want to talk about it, a lot of it depends like on context, because the Hottentot Venus, remember, was put in a cage and displayed for people to come touch her butt. And I think in the context of the 19th century notions of African primitivity and African lack of humanity, in that context, I mean, it was a very dehumanizing representation of that particular attribute of her body. Now, I don't think all representations of body parts are necessarily negative. So in other contexts, you could argue that that could be empowering. But I think, I think the Hottentot Venus, I mean, I'm assuming your question is to say that this imagery has changed to some extent. Is that what you're getting at in terms of your question?
That maybe, it was almost a question about sort of scholarly choice. I mean, will the response to your analysis be what you hope it will be? If we are so accustomed to glorifying big black butts that we no longer see, we can understand the idea of being put in a cage and ripped from your homeland. But on some level, we deeply understand the curiosity and fascination with the butt. And so that part of it starts to be being normal and, of course, to be expected and maybe even not to bad.
Well, I think there are two levels of that. One is, I think the different context makes it slightly different. But I think the objectification of women's body parts is an issue, generally. And that, I mean, if you reduce women to their body parts, what are the implications of that from a cultural perspective for our society? I think it's problematic. It may exist. It may be informed to some extent. And certainly we see images of bodies everywhere. We see images of body parts pervasively in the media, in the internet. But I think there's some problematic issues connected to that with respect to how we perceive women more broadly in society. And the fact that, what are the implications from a power perspective if women are consistently objectified as a collection of body parts? I think it has relevance and concern. Despite, and in some ways, the normality, it makes it more problematic because it makes it harder to say, well, this is problematic, right? Because it's normal. 11-year-old girls are dancing saying, you know, look at my butt. But I think we have, from a broader societal perspective, I think there are implications we can't forget about in that what's the meaning, what's the significance for women more generally if women are consistently objective?
It may in fact be, sort of exercising moderation prerogative to follow up on that, it may be that, you know, sort of confronting people with that, which is shocking in the 21st century, may cause people to rethink, well, should it really be commonplace or part of the background to have this culture of rap or other images that we find mostly out of objection, and maybe this makes us rethink those things. Rebecca?
So I guess my first impulse is to talk about Charlotte Perkins Gilman and the Yellow Room, which is to say that people whose passions don't fit what mainstream society thinks that they should are often labeled as crazy, and particularly so when they're not doing things that women are supposed to be doing, right? So, I mean, and this is not to say that they may not also be experiencing pain. This ties in actually to Severin's concern about letting you make money, right? If your only outlet is to scribble on the walls, that may not be the situation that you'd like to find yourself in. That may not be the creativity that you would do in the world that was best configured for you. But I suppose the IP question is: do we say that creativity is illegitimate? The results of that? Do we think that we will get mentally healthier people if we tell them not to write? And so back to the Yellow Room, I think the answer is no. You get mentally less healthy people. But also, I think mainstream culture tends to condemn passion as pathological in circumstances that it doesn't necessarily need to be. It can become pathological if the conditions
of expressing it are such that, you know, basically you become crazy by trying to deal with the world that doesn't, that won't see things as your way, and in fact sort of laughs at you, right? And actually, I'm sort of thinking about Senator Obama's speech about the way you start to see the world when no one in power, you know, thinks that your way of seeing things makes any sense, right? Of course, you start to get angrier and angrier, and you know, but that the pathology is not in you; it's in the system that created this incredibly narrow channel that for an outlet. And so, to the extent that people are, you know, writing stories at home at midnight because they're very unhappy, I think the stories are probably helpful for that. And the problem, the solutions to their unhappiness are, you know, instructional reform, and IP law should basically not add to their problems.
And let's hope that blue state laws don't work that well.
Well, you know, I think the debate over that is quite interesting, because there is this sort of fine line, right? The accounts of creativity and depression suggest that, you know, there's this bell curve, right? I mean, if you're really happy, no, you probably aren't creative. And then if you're unhappy, you go, and then of course you then lie in bed all day, and then you're not creative again either. And it's very, very hard to stay kind of on the downward slope, but not into the pedal.
Or on the upward. Psychologists think, or psychiatrists think, it's mainly productive
right.
Moments. It's the
upward. And again, this is to suggest that economic models of rationality are ludicrously misdescriptive of how humans behave, right? If that is the creative cycle, then the idea of rational calculation, you know, it's like, it's more than the cone. It's like, you know, sort of handing an orange to a polar bear. Like, it doesn't, you know, it's not helpful.
And with the hope that we will all stay on the upward slope.